She's one of Australia's most prolific and popular designers, and yet not many people know her name, let alone the story of her audacious life. Florence Broadhurst grew up in regional Queensland, but those who met her later in life thought she was British and an aristocrat. She reinvented herself many times throughout her life.
Just how fabulous was her past?
There were times when she made up some interesting stories.
But who was the real Florence Broadhurst?
Florence's story is a story of knowing you're different to everybody else.
Today she's known for her wallpaper designs that cemented her place in Australian design history. But a shadow lingers over her legacy. Her unsolved murder in 1977.
It was a shock.
I don't feel that the investigation was very thorough.
All the evidence disappeared.
I'm Zoe Ferguson, and for ABC Rewind, as a longtime admirer of her extraordinary designs, I decided to try and unravel the many intriguing lives of Florence Broadhurst and the circumstances behind her brutal end. For one of the most influential and famous Australian designers of her time, I'm always surprised how few people seem to recognise the name Florence Broadhurst. I first heard about Florence through my sister Laura, who learned about her work while she was studying interior design in Sydney.
Initially, I was drawn to Florence Broadhurst for the really strong, dynamic, bold prints. And then, you know, you look into the cockatoos and all of a sudden you've got this playfulness and really soft feeling, and then it all of a sudden goes to the geometric turnabouts where you have interlocking shapes that seem to move in front of you.
And we didn't just see them as wallpapers. We saw them as artworks.
So you've got to have that emotive response to her, and I really did. And I felt the energy and life from those artworks really coming out and speaking to me.
After falling in love with Florence the designer, we then read about Florence the woman and discovered she had an incredible life.
Florence Broadhurst presents a very colourful, not to say flamboyant, picture.
Well, she was what I think most people would think of as a typical artist, very colourful woman.
Orange-red hair, multi-striped black and white dress, and at least six rings, two bracelets, a jewelled watch and earrings.
But there were mysteries about her too.
Florence lived many lives in her 78 years. She was a Queensland farm girl, a society lady. She was a performer, a teacher, a dressmaker, and even ran a car and truck garage.
Oh, no, you shouldn't have brought that up. Not truck driver, oh, dear.
But it was her final chapter that really defined her and made a mark on Australian culture and design history.
I'm really a designer. I've been born a designer, and I've really been a designer all my life of one sort or another.
That's Florence talking on the ABC's Ellis Blaine Show in 1969. Blaine asked her about her childhood, and she paints quite a picture.
My father was out here for some time and then back again in England as a cattle breeder. And he was breeding cattle, and there's a place in London called Broadhurst Gardens. I don't find cattle very interesting. I go to the country here and you talk to the cows and they don't take any notice. Perhaps I was one of the branch of the family who strayed away from it.
Was your father a wealthy man?
Yes.
Did this give you necessarily a happy childhood?
Yes. He was able to buy me a piano because I wanted a piano at seven and a musician, to become a musician, so he bought me a piano.
Did you have servants?
Oh, yes, always.
Lies. Lies, lies, lies. It's a fantasy and an interesting one.
That's Helen O'Neill, journalist and author of the biography Florence Broadhurst, Her Secret and Extraordinary Lives.
The truth of the background she was born into bears very little resemblance to what she's describing in really vivid terms here. And quite apart from anything else, she's pretending to be British because she had realised in Australia that if you want to get ahead, perhaps you need to press certain buttons. And the English aristocracy was absolutely one of them.
So where was Florence born?
Florence Maud Broadhurst was born on the 28th of July, 1899, in a little place called Mungie Station, which is near Mount Perry in Queensland. Tiny little place in a cattle station where her father was managing the property. this was sort of hard knocks living. But it wasn't too long before you see Florence, who always had the straightest of backs and wonderful deportment, looking sort of regal compared to her school chums.
And the way she held and presented herself was her secret weapon to get out of Mount Perry, out of Queensland and out of Australia.
She's clearly not terribly interested in staying in that dusty cattle station. She manages to sing her way out of the bush in her late teen years, onto the stage.
Florence gets a gig as a singer in an ensemble, and with it, a ticket out of Australia.
Introducing the Smart Set Diggers.
So she joined a troupe called the Smart Set Diggers, which was one of a number of performing troupes that she joined, and was getting great reviews. She knew that she was, as she later put it, destined for more.
As Florence steps on board a ship for an overseas tour, she undergoes her first transformation. She becomes Miss Bobby Broadhurst.
The sort of milieu that she was stepping into was an interesting one too, because these performers, they were a lot of oddballs, but amazingly talented oddballs. So you had people who would not have been accepted in society back at that time, cross-dressers, gay men, gay women. So when she stepped on board that first vessel to take her to those other countries to perform, she started to become something that was really very unusual for a woman of her age. She was travelling alone, she had no husband. She was just there to be herself.
Then in 1926, after years of touring and performing in Kuala Lumpur, Bangkok, Delhi and Hong Kong, Florence goes to Shanghai.
Why was Shanghai called Paris of the East? It's quite an amazing place.
That's Andrew Field, Associate Professor of Chinese History at Duke Quinshan University.
Well, Shanghai in the 1920s and 30s was characterized by three words: light, heat and electricity. By the 1920s had become quite a decadent city. So it was associated with Paris in terms of the number of its brothels, as well as other nighttime spaces, such as cabarets. There were dazzling neon lights going down the main roads of the city, like Nanjing Road. You would just see a parade of neon signs advertising the ballrooms and the cabarets and the hotels and the nightclubs, the cinemas and all the other fun entertainment zones of the city.
And when jazz came to Shanghai in the 1920s, the city was full of Westerners.
Several thousand Americans, British and French, and a scattering of other nationalities. And it was those people who kicked off the jazz age in the city, dancing to jazz tunes and started learning the foxtrot and the Charleston.
It was in this heady time that Florence sang and danced on stage and then reinvented herself again, this time as an entrepreneur.
In 1926, launched what she called the Broadhurst Academy, which is a finishing school. She offers to teach everything from violin to pianoforte, as they called it, musical culture, banjolele playing, and the Charleston. So she's bringing her performing background into teaching a smorgasbord of things, targeting the wealthy British and American expats in the area. She wouldn't have told anyone where she came from at that point. I wonder if it's the first time Florence really began to develop that British accent. Because why would you employ someone from Nowheresville in Queensland to teach Darling Daphne how to behave at the royal court? You wouldn't.
Well, I think there are lots of stories of people from the Western world or the outside world coming to Shanghai, coming with a dollar in their pocket and reinventing themselves and becoming taipans of industry. It was a boom town, so I'm sure that Florence Broadhurst's story was very typical of that time.
But revolution was brewing in China.
Between 1926 and 1927, foreigners in Shanghai were very nervous, and many, in fact, left the country fearing the worst.
In April 1927, hundreds of communists were arrested and tortured or killed. It was dubbed the Shanghai Massacre, and it was a pivotal moment in the Chinese Revolution.
Florence wisely dipped out, came back to Queensland to see the family and stay with them for a while in Mount Perry.
During this trip back home, Florence did shows at her father's pub, but one night an after-party went terribly wrong. She borrowed her dad's car with some friends and took a corner too fast. The car rolled and they survived. But Florence suffered a fractured skull. And we don't know why, but this incident marked the end of her career as a performer.
You would think, perhaps, that that might be the end of it, and she might have found a nice husband nearby and married into, you know, the cattle-breeding royalty. No, she then went to London to start again.
London, 1929. Florence falls in love and marries her first husband, Percy Khan.
It's a Catholic wedding. He's a stockbroker. The stock market was having big ups and downs at that time. And it's possible that the man, the family into which Florence thought she was marrying, wasn't quite as she'd hoped it would be. Florence, at some point, begins to work with a dressmaker in London called Madame Corot.
In the early 1930s, she opens her own dressmaking salon.
Florence and her husband had become co-directors for something called Pellier Limited, Robes and Modes, which was in New Bond Street in London. And to do this, Florence had created a new persona.
Florence becomes a French dressmaker and calls herself Madame Pellier.
When I was looking at the images of Madame Pellier, I could see Florence's face, but everything else is different. Her hairstyle is slicked down onto her head. She looked almost like one of those wonderful Hollywood movie stars from the black and white era. Very much a chic flapper style. She took out adverts that were beautifully illustrated and very cleverly written, telling the hoi polloi of London that if they needed something super special, she was the woman to go to because she was a French couturier who could make anything, darling, anything.
It's around this time that Florence and Percy separate. And then in the mid to late 1930s, Florence falls pregnant with her first and only child, Robert.
But not to her previous husband, Percy Khan. Florence had taken up with someone who's described on her son's birth certificate as a fruit merchant of 124 Kensington Park Road, Kensington.
But World War II is looming, so Florence shuts up shop and Madame Pellier is no longer. We don't know much about Florence during the war years because there's a bit of a gap in the archives. We know she's living in Surrey and joins the Australian Women's Voluntary Services, but little else. After the war, in 1949, Florence, her new husband, Leonard Lloyd Lewis, and their baby boy, Robert, travel to Sydney and settle in Manly.
With Leonard, she began a series of businesses that really related around trucking and cars and transport, that kind of thing.
And in her spare time, Florence tries her hand at being an artist, painting Australian landscapes.
And sold them to the press as the visions of someone who'd never seen this before because they came from the UK and they were in Sydney to recover from the ravages of World War II. She wanted to be a great artist. And she did have some success. It was a very proud moment when the David Jones Art Gallery gave her a solo show.
But despite a couple of exhibitions in the mid-1950s, her painting career doesn't take off. So she puts aside those ambitions and focuses on running the family business. But only a few years later, Leonard moves to Queensland, leaving Florence and their son Robert to run the car yard in St Leonard's.
So Florence at this point is knocking on 60. So for many people, this is when you start winding down. She has discovered that her husband is leaving her for a woman younger than their son. Her entire world is collapsing. He's her business partner as well as the father of their only child. many people at that point, I think, would retreat from the limelight and lick their wounds. Florence did something really different.
Florence, if you could live your life over, would you change anything?
Yes, I'd change it all.
To what?
The whole lot.
You can't be serious.
I'm perfectly serious. I wouldn't have married the men I did, and I wouldn't have stayed with them if I did. I should have had confidence to leave them and live my own life and express myself. I feel it's too late in the day. I'm trying to make up all the time for the years I wasted. So I change everything.
As the 50s draw to a close, Florence opens a new chapter. Her life as a designer begins, all thanks to a moment of serendipity. One story goes that she went out to the shed behind the car yard to nag her young tenant to pay his rent. And when she went in, she saw he had wallpaper designs and colours he was experimenting with. She instinctively guided him, saying, no, these wouldn't sell, but this would.
And taught the tenant into creating for her the first of a series of designs that would later turn her into what she'd always wanted to be, which is an artistic figurehead in a city that needed, she felt, art, colour, vibrancy, culture.
And so in 1959, she started her wallpaper business in the shed behind the car yard.
Florence didn't just open up a wallpaper factory. What she opened up was a design studio where she employed artists to create artworks, which she then reproduced as high-level hand-printed wallpapers, going from crazy psychedelics to amazing, almost anti-art, geometrics that sometimes cross over into Art Deco swirls.
Yes, well, you have to, because to balance a collection, you see, if I had all period designs, then what about the other people who want mod? You couldn't go on doing the period design, you'd get bored too. And you know that there's a call for now bright psychedelic colours and flowers, which I like. Well, then I do that in advance of people. I lead them into it. I've led them into colour now tremendously, because I know that I have the feeling for colour.
Literally, they're the only person doing this in Australia, sure.
Yes, I am the only person in Australia doing it.
I think her studio was unique in Australian design history. She was pushing the boundaries of what wallpaper could actually do at that point, developing foil wallpapers, all sorts of things that were not common and not easy to make.
I was sitting at my manicurist waiting for her to come along and looked at my thumbnail, which just looked so beautiful and so highly sort of pearlized. And I thought, now that's what I should do. And by the time she came, I decided then to coat paper in with this nail polish. And so I rang up France and they told me where to get it. And I rang up Japan and we got this nail polish, which I now coat the paper with, and it's coated in mother of pearl.
This kaleidoscope of inspiration culminates in the vast and vibrant range of wallpaper designs Florence creates in the 60s and 70s, making an indelible mark on Australian design history. Some of her hallmark designs include one called Peacocks. Two peacocks sit on a branch, looking in opposite directions, their tails draping down. Another popular design is called Japanese Floral. That's one of my favourites. The flowers stand on stalks, reaching upwards, unfurling their petals. It's simple, elegant, and active all at once. Florence used metallic papers for these designs, which really made them pop. They were completely different to what was on the walls of Australian homes at the time. Can you tell me about what was deemed risky in terms of interior design in the 1960s in Australia when you came here?
Oh, my God. A lot of things.
That's Babette Hayes.
I'm a journalist interior designer. I've been at it for years and years. I came to Australia in 1965.
And she noticed that Australians were very safe in their choices of interior design and wallpaper, and mostly importing it from overseas.
Because it wasn't produced in huge quantities locally. But the thing about someone like Florence was that she produced unique designs. Some of them were incredibly large geometrics. There was one paper that was a whole row of Persian fans big, big fans. Then there was another paper that had lots of beautiful peacocks. So you had to have the courage and the guts to use these in your home or in the office or wherever you were going to use them.
People have been waiting for someone to do that. They've been waiting to be led into it. They have no choice. If they haven't got the choice, how can they express themselves?
Florence's designs are elegant and timeless. And at a studio tucked away in St. Peter's in Sydney, there are stacks of her original silkscreen prints. It's kind of tucked behind the Princess Highway, and it's off a really famous laneway called May Lane. It's walls and corrugated iron, backs of gardens and sheds, just covered in street art.
Decades ago, David Lenny became the custodian of Florence's silkscreen prints when he bought Signature Prints, the company that owned the Florence Broadhurst Library.
Hi, nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
He and his small team spent years identifying and restoring the design archive. And right now, we're standing in front of them, hundreds of original Florence Broadhurst wallpaper silk screens. They've got wooden frames with a silkscreen patterned insert, and they're about a metre high and wide.
Her wallpaper was a bit wider than normal, wasn't it?
She went straight to American standard, which is 70 wide. So all the English and European, which was all that had come to Australia before, was all 50, 52.
Why do you think she made it wider?
Because you could have a bigger design. It gave you much more design freedom. It was really clever.
And all the buckets are all the raw ingredients. You can see the metallics shimmering.
Oh, they're beautiful.
Yeah, all here.
Yeah.
To show me how it works, Sheridan Black, the owner of Signature Handprints, jumps into action and picks up a silkscreen of curly swirls. It's a timeless and psychedelic design. She lays paper on the long table and then places the silkscreen over the paper, pours black paint on top, and with a squeegee-looking tool, runs the paint all the way down the screen.
So it's the concept of open and closed.
Mm-hmm.
So certain sections of the screen are open. And so if I hold it up and show it to you, if you look through certain sections, you can see me. So they're called open. Oh. And that's where the ink passes through.
Okay. How many designs did she make?
She said she had over 1,000 designs. Whether that was true or not, whether some had been disposed of, who knows. But we finished up with 530.
That's an extraordinary number, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. It's a huge library, much, much too big to have come out of one person's hand. It's come out of a design studio.
There's some debate over whether Florence physically drew every wallpaper design herself, as she claimed. Florence's son Robert insists she did, but others, like David Lenny, think that's a little hard to believe.
Her design students and her designers worked under her level of excellence. That's what you're doing. You're not holding the pen every day, but you can look over a shoulder and say, no, put that branch there, or no, put that bird there. That's what your job is. And when you go through the library, they are really good designs because they are balanced and they work.
Some people felt that hers wasn't the pen, that the pen belonged to the girls that she employed. There's also the fact that in the 70s, her eyesight was becoming so compromised. But the artistic vision was Florence. The hands were someone else's.
How do we know that the hand wasn't hers?
I didn't really talk to anybody who could tell me that it was.
Florence and her designers worked really closely together, but that didn't mean they always got on.
There were times when she was really quite harsh when she talked to her staff. Because she was very clear-cut about the way she wanted things to be, there was no nonsense about what she had to say. But in the end, it didn't seem to stop a lot of people because she was adding more and more printing tables. They were working incredible hours on producing a huge amount of wallpaper.
But even though Florence may not have physically drawn each design, she was the designer. And in her designs, you can see glimpses of her life, places she'd been, cultures she'd experienced, and fabrics she loved.
Everything Florence had seen in her remarkable life. Everywhere she'd been has voice in the images, in one place or another. You can see shadowed, and sometimes it's right in your face, the Orient, but specific things about the Orient, garments that she is photographed wearing. She had this innate understanding of what people wanted to buy. She really knew people.
Her product was expensive, so it had to be people who had money.
To meet her list of clients, you'd have to start at the very top of the social register and then very gradually make your way down.
For a decade, Florence and her small team worked together in the workshop out the back of the truck yard on Sydney's North Shore. Then, in 1969, she moved to the inner eastern suburb of Paddington, closer to her clientele. I'm in Paddington in Sydney, standing outside of a pretty nondescript row of units, and it's where Florence's wallpaper studio used to be. She wanted to be among high society's movers and shakers, those with style, flair, and money. The new premises had a big factory downstairs that buzzed with designers, while upstairs there was a showroom and Florence's office. And Florence showed no signs of slowing down, despite her age.
You must be able to go on talking to people and go on designing. You don't sit down and chew the end of your pencil, wonder what's going on next. Your ideas must flow all the time. There's never a time when you haven't got dozens, and you mustn't stop. It's no effort.
But it's here, at her Paddington studio, that her incredible story is cut short.
Because she was like a flame. It was as though nothing could extinguish her. But something did.
Police today said they were carrying out routine investigations.
On October the 15th, 1977, Florence Broadhurst was murdered.
Apparently, the assailant walked into the building through the open door.
It was a shocking murder, a shocking attack on a woman. The way she was beaten up and attacked was a horrific story.
The neighbour had expressed concern for Florence Broadhurst in her factory as the front door was left open all night and the lights are on. He asked us to attend to check on her welfare.
Tony Russell says he was one of the two police officers first on the scene who discovered Florence's body.
I basically walked out. I was in shock. I needed fresh air because I was going to faint.
Next time in part two, the circumstances around Florence's untimely end and the police investigation into her murder.
I don't feel that the investigation was very thorough.
Detectives couldn't find the physical evidence collected at the time.
Obviously, it was someone who felt a lot of hate and anger.
It appeared that Florence had known her killer.
As I've grown to understand my grandmother's story from different perspectives, our story has been surrounded by trauma and grief.
That's next time on ABC Rewind. Today's episode was written and produced by me, Zoe Ferguson. The sound engineer was Simon Branthwaite.